Mr. Heron, Reel 8. We're talking about when you were at HMS Mercury near Petersfield, Hampshire, around about 1943-44. We don't know the date. And you were lecturing in navigational aids. We're just running through them.
Yes. Let me recap on that. There were three main navigational aids used for various purposes. There was Loran, that's L-O-R-A-N, which was the worldwide or almost worldwide low frequency location by means of phase. Do you want me to go through the technicalities? By phase difference, by transmitters, they used the and they were in rugby. As far as England was concerned, they had them in the States and in other parts of the world. So it was a fairly wide-ranging, long-distance, not too accurately, but long-range navigational aids to assist those craft or ships or whatever that needed some form of additional checking on location. G, as I mentioned before, was the one of the other two, and was used primarily for aircraft, bomber flights into Germany, etc. The third one, I can't remember the name of it, it was made by Pye, the PYE of Cambridge, and was short range but very accurate form of navigational aid, and was the primary navigational aid used during D-Day. And my job was lecturing on these, the maintenance of the equipment, and instruct them in the use of the equipment and its the abilities or the facilities it offered. I had at one time one class which terrified me somewhat. Of all the senior officers, this was before D-Day, with all the senior officers from the various admiralty and so on, I mean, they were several rear admirals, vice admirals, and primarily arranged by Mountbatten, so that prior to D-Day, they would know what, you know, with the planning of, for example, the mine sweeping along the north coast of France was vital to the first approaches. It was a very dangerous operation, but had to be extremely highly navigated with a high degree of accuracy. So that was where that system came in. I'll think of the name of it when I try later on, when I'm not trying. And so there I was, so that was it. I was lecturing, playing cricket for Leydeen. I enjoyed that. And we played on one of the oldest cricket pitches in England. It was, I've got actually, I think it was 1772 or somewhere around about there, All England against Hambledon, where the scores were England 79 and Hambledon 365, or something of that nature, played by all the bigwigs of that time were playing for Hambledon, of course. And the few, I don't think they were professionals.
That's a bit before our time, though.
Yes, right.
Anything else you remember from that time?
No, not really. It was I got married in while I was at Petersfield, and we were in digs there, and our first child was born there at a little cottage hospital called Sheet, in Sheet, which is a little village outside of Petersfield. And I was then on my way to joining, after this period, I joined a flotilla of LCGs, which were...
LCG?
Yes, an LCG, that's a landing craft gun, They were a Mark III landing craft, British-built landing craft, with one 4.7 gun mounted in the well deck. And during my visit to the museum of the North, they mentioned every craft I know of in Normandy, on the museum in D-Day, museum in Normandy, everything but LCGs. I couldn't find them anywhere.
Now, what were you joining them as? You were a petty officer.
Yeah.
What were you joining as?
Well, I was joining in charge of the maintenance of the communication equipment on the flotilla. When I say a flotilla, I think there were about 8 or 9 LCGs in that flotilla. And they carried very basic equipment, so it wasn't too difficult.
What sort of thing?
Well, there was an army backpack was the main thing that was carried on board. They had, in addition to that, fairly simple receivers.
Did the flotilla have a number, you know, or was it just a landing craft gun LCG flotilla to you?
Yes, yeah, so to me it was LCG flotilla. If there were any numbers, I can't remember them.
And what happened next then?
Well, the next thing was we were training for D-Day.
Now, what do you remember of the training for D-Day?
Well, mainly it was trying to keep this equipment, which was... it was very broke down fairly easily. I seem to have spent my whole time running around from LCG to LCG repairing the equipment, but where it had been knocked about, it was getting fairly hectic treatment, and also training the personnel on there to use it, because they were very basic operators. They had no previous experience, or very little, of communications.
And where were these exercise landing practices taking place?
In Southampton. And
that's where you were based, was it?
That's where we were based, yes, in Southampton. And this was all the prior to D-Day. And apart from that and my home life, which was developing at that time, there was nothing very exciting except the fact that everything was very secret and secure, and and as far as I was concerned, I had spent the 2 or 3 weeks before D-Day stuck on the landing craft.
Tell me about the secrecy though. I mean, were you very aware of how secret this all was?
Oh yes, we were aware of it, and we knew what it was for. So I mean, it was obvious that we were being kept under wraps kept in the base. Well, there was a base there of some sort, I think, but mainly it were just masses and masses of troops, and my own particular thing stuck on an LCG, which wasn't very comfortable, but it was that was a necessity, and we were stayed on there for about 2 weeks, two or three weeks prior to the invasion.
Now, what do you remember of the channel crossing and the actual landing on the 6th of June?
I remember, first of all, was that it seemed a bit chaotic to start with, because there were these masses of landing craft. And, of course, although a lot of them, of course, were launched from the LCIs, I think they call LCIs, which were the main land carrying several smaller landing craft to put them ashore, put the troops ashore. We sailed across, of course, on the LCGs. No, sorry, take that back. The control of these LCGs was from an LCI. I think they were called LCIP personnel, because they were small, quite small landing craft, not actual landing craft. LCIs were had no bow, no dropping bow or anything like that for the actual landing. They were just small boats with superstructure, of course, where they had an office or two. And that's where I remember now, instead of staying on the LCG, most of the time, I did spend some time on the LCGs, but also on the LCI. And I remember going over the captain of the LCI was fanatical about nobody lighting cigarettes or anything like that on the upper deck. And
what was it like on the crossing?
Very rough. Well, rough. Not as bad as my North Atlantic effort, but it was pretty rough. And
were you nervous?
Well, do you know, I don't think so. I think the reason we knew we weren't going to land. I mean, this was not, and there was such an enormous support. I mean, we saw and heard the aircraft going over prior to the actual landing, the aircraft, and then the bombardment started from the, I'm sure that everybody knows this by now, I mean, started from the monitors and the battleships out, as far out, firing way inland, and then the cruisers, destroyers, say, operating 10 to 20 miles inland, and then you had us with the 4.7s. We were firing into the beyond the beach areas and into it further inland, say, let's say between 5 and 10 miles, something like that, inland. And then in front of us, going close in, was the LCMs, which carried light Bofors-type guns, light guns attacking the actual beach emplacements. The whole thing was such a... And there was, of course, the rocket ships firing several hundred, I think it was 100-odd rockets at a time. That was... the whole thing was so enormously noisy and chaotic and generally that I don't think we had time to be... You know, the whole thing was... Well, indescribable. I mean, it was just... inferno, almost like an inferno. We were landing, we were covering the British sector, which was
Juno
Beach, that's right, and they had a pretty fairly easy, if you compare it, for example, with the Americans on the right flank, who were, I can't remember, there was Saw, Juno, I can't remember offhand the
so
other
what beaches. Happened on, what happened, what do you remember seeing on Juno?
Well, Juno, I remember seeing a lot of the aircraft, a lot of aircraft flying over, and also, of course, a lot of the landing craft being tipped over on the approaches to the beach. Some of them were stopped short of the beach and the troops. But in the main, they got ashore. There was not a lot of flak coming from the shore. It was a fairly easy landing from what I could see and what I've heard of since of the general thing. They had a pretty easy landing at Juno.
And what were you doing on board the command boat, Landing Craft Infantry?
Well, nothing very much. I was communicating... The captain was merely, the LCG was giving instructions, and I just kept the equipment going for him to give the instructions verbally across to the guys on the other landing craft. Actually, everything worked fine, so with the exception of one or two of the landing craft failed to come back, but they just followed the lead of the rest.
So you were quite, it was quite a quiet, you didn't have much
I didn't have much to do with the actual landing. In fact, only hours after the landing was initially made, we were back in Southampton.
And that's all you remember about D-Day?
Yes, it wasn't anything, and I seem to have contributed very little.
So what happened next then? You seem to have been sent to Belfast.
Yes, that's right. I got back to Leydeen, though, first, I think, for a short period, and then sent to Belfast to join another squadron, or flotilla, of LCGs.
And what were you doing there? Same thing?
Same thing, four-point LCGs with four-point. This time, they were equipped for long-distance routes. And
how was that done?
Well, they had these 4.7 guns, of course, mounted on the well deck, and they sealed the bows of the landing craft, and they set up what they did as before. Of course, they were just the 4.7s on an open well deck, but now they'd converted the actual well deck round the gun into a mess deck and a galley and heads up front, up in the bows. So we had sort of quarters by this time.
So that was being done at the Belfast, the dock, the shipyard?
That was being done in the shipyard, and they'd already sent two of these on the way to India.
Two flotillas?
No, two or three LCGs. They didn't go in a full flight, and apparently they'd broken their backs in the bay. There were some problems with it anyway, in the sense that with the being flat-bottomed, they were constantly under pressure on the deck, and the steel plates were actually cutting off the heads of the rivets, which caused them to pop, and they sort of broke their backs. But, well, that's what I heard, because obviously I wasn't on that particular flight. And what happened, I think they were repaired in Gibraltar. But anyway, when we sailed, we had a crew of about 30. Yes, probably 30, including cooks and bottle washers and all the rest. And I was then, yes, I was...
Were you on an LCG, or were you again on a command boat?
No, I was on, no, there was no command boat at that time. We were actually, I was on the flotilla leader, I think, which was an LCG built in the way I just mentioned. And we proceeded from there down to... I think we went to Southampton again and then sailed for Gibraltar, which was quite an experience.
Tell us about that.
Well, it was, for a start, fortunately it wasn't too rough, but we still, the pressure on the thing, when it the bow and the stern were seen to be on wave tops, and the ship was sort of, I don't know what the word would be, flexing is the word, and causing all sorts of problems internally. But, and of course, the crew, it was approaching Christmas, I remember that, it was a Christmas time. And we were in the bay during Christmas of that year. That might help us to get a bit more timing as to the dates and so on. And we arrived in Gibraltar in a worse state than you can possibly imagine, and we decided to have our Christmas dinner there, where the captain got thoroughly drunk and was finished up, laid over the bollard alongside, he was draped over the bollard alongside the ship, which wasn't very... But in those days, the naval standard discipline and orderliness didn't apply very much on these small ships. It was more every man in what chance you got to enjoy yourself, to hell with any rules and regulations. It was pretty well a free-for-all. And, we had all sorts of incidents. We had fights on there, and I don't know. But anyway, finally we arrived in Gibraltar and had our Christmas celebrations.
What do you remember of yourself?
In Christmas, that brought back the memory. An actual fright started in the mess deck when we had all the poor old chefs, and there were people fighting over the food in the middle of the mess deck, which was quite a small mess deck, you know, bigger than an average, sort of twice the size of a living room, average living room. And the chef was in tears. They cooked all this thing, and people were sort of fighting and trampling all over the food. It was a chaotic. What I can remember of it was an absolute chaos. But anyway, things sobered up after Christmas, and we got underway to sail along the North African coast towards Port Said. And we visited two places, Tel El Kebir and Tunis. On the way, I think it was Tunis, yes, I think so, on the way to Port Said. Had a couple of days ashore there in those two places, and got into Port Said and proceeded down to, through the canal, down to Port, we didn't go to Tewfik. Yes, we did. We stopped off on the way at the lakes. I've forgotten the name of the
Bitter Lakes.
Is it the Bitter Lakes? They're halfway down the canal. We stopped there briefly and then went on down to Port Tewfik. And from Port Tewfik, nothing very startling. We did a lot of fishing for sharks, would you believe? Because the Red Sea was, when we went on down into the Red Sea, they were absolutely loaded with sharks down there. And we used to have one of these big butcher's hooks on a hawser with a big slab of meat out and bring these. And we used to eat these. We cooked the sharks. I think we got two in the process of going down to Aden. But once they got on the flat deck, on the iron deck there, I mean, they were thrashing around. If you got in the way, they'd break your leg. And so anyway, we got and that was part of the operational exercises, was fishing. Then we went on down to Aden. From Aden, which was, of course, just prior to that, and still was, strangely enough, still partially a coaling depot for the Navy, and had been for years prior to that time. And we then sailed on to Cochin, and that's where we got into Cochin.
Where's Cochin, sorry?
Cochin is on the southwest coast of India, about a couple of hundred miles, I suppose, from Sri Lanka. And
what happened there? Cochin.
No, we went down to Sri Lanka. Well, what was then Ceylon, of course. Went down to Ceylon, and at the base there. Oh Lord, I forgot my name.
Trincomalee.
Oh. I'd say you're better informed than I am. Anyway, we got down to Trincomalee, had a few days there, and then we went up to a place called Mandapam, which was a little village on the Indian side of Adams Bridge joining Ceylon and India.
So the Ceylon side?
On the Indian side, right on the coast, a little tiny village, and they were converting it into a combined operations base. And that base I have vivid memories of. because it was absolute purgatory there.
Why?
They built bashers, or they call bashers, which was made up of a sort of basic wall into a sleeping quarters for about, I think it was about 12 people, 12 to 14 people in a caboosh. And then on the top they made the roof of palm leaves. And every conceivable bug, animal, vicious items lived in these bloody palm leaves over the beds. And they used to put the beds were made of wooden supports, wooden legs and supports down the sides. And in the middle was raffia strung between around the thing, and then you had your some sort of palliasse laid on top. But nothing. And they used to put kerosene, tins of kerosene, with the legs into the tins to prevent them from climbing up the legs, which was a waste of time anyway, because they just dropped on you from up top. And although I don't seem to remember when we didn't have nets. We did get some eventually, but we didn't have nets at the time, mosquito nets. But we had these, and these bed bugs seemed to get at you no matter what. And there were scorpions there, and I even knocked one off the head of one of my chums there, who'd taken his cap out of the locker, put it on his head, and he stopped. I saw his face change, and he took his hat off, and there was a scorpion sitting on the top of his head. So he said, "For God's sake, Reg, do something." So I picked up a newspaper and swiped it off the top of his head. It was a frightening. And also, of course, the other thing, it was absolutely steaming hot and humid. And the only escape you got was to go into the sea, which was, you were on the beach, but the sea was almost as hot as it was ashore. And, of course, me with my very fair skin, I got burnt and up. It was a period of absolute purgatory as far as living conditions were concerned. We had a few days. We were sent up to Bangalore, which was the... Bangalore was an ex-hill station for the various Europeans in that area, and for the main military personnel. It was up in the hills and fairly cool, reasonably cool and pleasant up there. And that was, we had I think it was a week up there. Then we came back down again, and I went up to Madras and Pondicherry, which were the old French colonies of the past.
What were you doing there?
No, just on leave. We'd go up there and had a happy time.
How did you like India?
I quite enjoyed it, actually, because it was so different to what up to then I'd experienced. I mean, it was for example, when we got into Cochin, the begging and the atrocious conditions that so many of the people there lived. Cochin was a very poor area. And there was elephantitis was one of the big complaints there. And you'd have these guys with testicles on their leg on the size of a football and things like that. I mean, this was extraordinary to me. It was fascinating, but at the same time, very depressing. I mean, up to then, I'd travelled in all the reasonably Western states. I mean, North Africa was pretty rough, but this was taking it to an extreme. Anyway, so from there we started operating up into Burma on an LCG. There'd be two, if I remember rightly, two of the LCGs would go up at a time, doing patrols in the Salween River.
Which river?
Salween. That's Salween. Salween River.
W-E-N.
W-E-N. Salween River. There'd been one disastrous one that was before we got up there, where they'd anchored in midstream during the night, and the Japs had swum off and slaughtered the lot of them on board. Unbelievable. God knows what they were doing. Either they caught the guard or he was asleep, or I don't know what happened. We never did know.
What were you meant to be doing, Ned,
this
patrol? Because you only had one 4.7.
Yeah, but no, we had rifles, and that's all. I mean, rifles, and I think there was a machine gun on board. So.